Impact of Influence, the Murdoch Family Murders. This is the unfolding story of a powerful South Carolina family, the mysterious deaths they are linked to, and our quest to bring you the truth. Hello, friend. So grateful you're going to spend some time with us. Matt Harris and Seton Tucker here. And there have been some moves made while we were away. We're glad you're back with us. You can find us on Facebook, Impact of Influence. This one will not be on the YouTube channel, but that will continue. And we're going to get to all of the things involving a potential new trial for Alec Murdoch based on jury tampering involving Becky Hill, the Colleton County Clerk of Courts. We'll do that. And when we get through that, you've got some kind of breaking stuff.
Yes, Fitz News just came out with a story where they talk about Becky Hill and her son, Jeffrey Hill's cell phones. There was a lot of switcheroo happening, some missing cell phones, and some factory resets. So we will talk about that at the end of this episode.
However, we are going to put at the end, as you said. So what would you like to start off with, Seton?
We now have a judge who has been assigned to oversee this evidentiary hearing, and that is former Chief Justice of the South Carolina Supreme Court, Jean Toll. She is a retired judge, but she has served on the judiciary as a senior judge since retiring, and she's 80 years old.
And she was the first woman and the first Roman Catholic to serve as Chief Justice.
There's been a lot of chatter about why she was chosen. You know, I wonder if she was chosen because she's not an active judge, so maybe she has more time.
Well, she also is going to be ruling in favor or against different attorneys and being caught up in the media spotlight and all that. Maybe if you're a younger person who's going to continue their
career,
it could be all entwined in controversy and for or against a prosecutor or a defense attorney or whatever.
She doesn't shy away from things. And I kind of wondered maybe she possibly asked to be in this role. Now, there's also been talk whether it's good or bad for the prosecution or defense. She has ties to Dick Harpootlian, but she was also recently photographed. I don't know where I saw that with Creighton Waters. So I don't know.
Anybody.
We all know each other.
He's going to be ties to Dick Harpootlian. He's been in the Senate and he's been part of Democratic politics and he's been part of South Carolina since the 70s.
Yes. You know, it just seems that she is an independent thinker. So I think she's going to rule the way she feels is the right thing to do.
She's also in a place, like I said, career advancement is not on her radar.
She's 80 and she's like, I'm going to do what I want.
Yep. We'll see how it all plays out.
So this is very quickly moving. We were thinking, I think in our last episode, that this was going to take months, but she's already held status conference and actually scheduled a public status conference for January 16th, which will be held at the Richland County Judicial Center.
Richland County is where Columbia is, which is the state capital.
And in preparation for that, we have briefs that have been filed by the defense and also the state.
And we'll get into those in a moment, but there's also some other scheduling that's happened.
On the calendar, we have the evidentiary hearing for the week of January 29th, much faster than I expected it to happen. And they have allotted 3 days for this hearing.
Now, we're not sure exactly what's going to happen during this. How's it going to look?
We're not quite clear exactly how this will look. And Chief Justice Toll has said she's committed to making it available to the public. But you also have to protect the identity of the jurors. And in these motions that we're about to dive into, both sides are setting forth arguments on how they would like this to look.
It seems like they're all settling into, let's keep the jurors as anonymous as possible.
Right, but it's also going to be who questions the jurors, whether it's going to be...
We don't know that yet, right?
The court, which would be Chief Justice Toll, or whether it would be the lawyers themselves.
The people I've been talking to seem to think Toll's going to do the questioning.
I think so, and actually, in the motions filed by the defense and the state, they both are pretty much saying that.
Accepting that. One of the things we should point out is that the Supreme Court of South Carolina took the case entirely out of Colleton County, which makes sense because that's where Becky Hill is the clerk of court still. And so Chief Justice Beatty issued that order that all documents, orders, and correspondence related to Murdoch motion for a new trial must be filed with the clerk of Supreme Court of South Carolina, and then they will take it, get a toll, and what will go on in Richland County.
Right. Seems to make sense. All right. So let's dive into the defendant's pre-hearing brief regarding the motion for a new trial. They argue that Mr. Murdoch does not need to show actual bias on the part of any juror to obtain a new trial. They're saying that because of the nature of these allegations, it doesn't matter whether it affected the outcome of the verdict.
This is what both sides are going to be have going on. The defense is going to say, as long as we can show that Becky Hill said things that were inappropriate, that might have swayed somebody, that's good enough. The prosecution side is going to say, no. Those jurors have to say, because of what she said, that's why we said guilty.
Right.
Now, she can talk, obviously she's talking to the jury the whole time. She can say, hey, what do you want to have for lunch? Things like that.
Yes, it's just the nature of her communications and if those communications were harmless, such as what do you want for lunch?
Right. And explain what it says in this particular brief, because they're going to use case law to make their argument whether or not it matters whether what she said affected the juror's verdict.
And this is what was written in the brief. Even if a juror were to testify that he or she would have reached the same verdict regardless of Ms. Hill's tampering, a new trial is required if it was proven that Ms. Hill communicated with jurors about the merits of the evidence presented.
And the other side's going to say, that's a bunch of horse hockey. So now we're talking about the preponderance of evidence.
Defense contends that the burden of proof is shifting because of this being a court official.
If Mr. Murdoch proves, this is from the filing, if Mr. Murdoch proves that the clerk of court engaged in surreptitious advocacy on the merits during trial, there is nothing for the state to rebut. A new trial is required. And just to reiterate what you said, the defense team is saying that because it's a court official, the whole thing with the state saying there has to be preponderance of evidence is out the window. They don't need a preponderance of evidence. They just need to show that a clerk official said something.
And I just want to remind people that once there is a guilty verdict, the preponderance of the evidence shifts from the state to the defense in regards to seeking a new trial.
Okay, yes, if you're going to overturn it, whatever, yes.
Right. So that's why the burden is on Alec Murdoch, but the defense is arguing that, no, it's not on him because Becky Hill being a court official.
Gotcha.
Their next thing they address is that they must hold an evidentiary hearing, but one has already been set, so they just say they're going to briefly rebut it, but I don't think we need to cover that because it looks like there will, in fact, be an evidentiary hearing, or at least one is on the calendar.
Correct. Let's move to what's in filing about Becky Hill.
They do discuss Becky Hill's credibility in their filing.
In the filing, it says, the state argues attacking Ms. Hill's character is an outlandish theory against a dedicated public servant that is, quote, immaterial, impertinent, and scandalous, and she should be struck. That is incorrect. Ms. Hill likely is the only witness the state can offer who can directly contradict Juror 630's averments of jury tampering, and Ms. Hill has offered an affidavit doing exactly that. And we go to New Trial Exhibit A. Her credibility is the crux of the matter before the court. The purpose of the evidentiary hearing is to allow the court to decide whether it believes the word of Ms. Hill more than it believes the sworn testimony of one or more jurors. Anything that impeaches Ms. Hill is relevant. And the state's rhetoric about Ms. Hill being a, quote, dedicated public servant, unfairly maligned, has not aged well in the 2 months since the state filed its response, to put it mildly. Ms. Hill is alleged to have stolen money, illegally sold access to the courthouse, conspired with her son to conduct illegal wiretaps, and even had her book removed from publication because of her plagiarism.
Okay, so let's break down what is happening with Clerk of Court Becky Hill. First, we have the release of her emails that several news organizations requested. Now, one thing that came to light in the release of her emails were some things to do with plagiarism.
So that brings us to this press release that Neil Gordon, the co-author who we've had on the show of the book Behind the Doors of Justice, here is the press release about these plagiarism revelations. He entitled it Behind the Doors of Justice Ceases Publication Amid Plagiarism Revelations, dated December 26th. The co-authors of the book Behind the Doors of Justice have made the difficult decision to unpublish the book and cease sales after revelations co-author Becky Hill plagiarized a portion of the book without co-author Neil Gordon's knowledge. Again, this is written by Neil Gordon. Gordon discovered the ethical gaffe while reviewing thousands of pages of Hill's emails released to reporters through the Freedom of Information Act, known as FOIA. Gordon came across an email exchange between Hill, the Carlton County clerk, and a BBC reporter, in which the reporter shared a long excerpt from an upcoming article about the Alec Murdoch trial, pages 1644 to 1648. When Gordon compared the article's text to a 12-page book passage in the preface, supposedly written by Hill, he realized she'd lifted the article's text and made it her own. Quote, when I confronted Becky about this, she admitted she plagiarized the passage due to deadline pressure, said Gordon. As a veteran journalist myself, I cannot excuse her behavior, nor can I condone it. Gordon immediately notified the BBC reporter about Hill's actions, and he's been told the media outlet's attorneys are investigating. Gordon's quote, this is blindsided me. Journalism has been my life's work. My credibility and integrity are paramount to everything I do. I can be associated with anything like plagiarism. Will no longer partner with Becky Hill on any projects. I'd like to apologize to our readers and publicly to the BBC and the reporter.
Well, I did check Amazon today, and it is still out there, and this is a week after that statement. So it still has not, I don't know if it takes time for Amazon to take things down.
I question that, because usually in a case like this, Amazon is printing as needed. They're not printing 500 books.
But maybe they printed some like in a bulk to I don't know, but it is still for sale. We do have a response from Becky Hill's attorneys. Let's read what she has to say about this.
It says, please attribute the following statement to attorneys Justin Bamberg and Will Lewis regarding plagiarism allegations against their client, Collinson County Clerk of Court. Maybe, yeah. Quote, Becky Hill is deeply remorseful regarding an allegation of plagiarism that has recently surfaced from her new book, Behind the Doors of Justice, The Murdoch Murders. The pressures of developing additional content under tight time deadlines resulted in Ms. Hill taking material written by a BBC reporter, Holly Hondrick, and submitting it to her co-author, Neil Gordon, as if it were her own words. Ms. Hill accepts full responsibility for this unfortunate lapse in judgment and has personally reached out to Ms. Hondrick to express her sincere apologies. The self-published book is only available online through Amazon and Audible, and the decision was made to unpublish the book for the foreseeable future until next steps for the book have been identified. Ms. Hill has great respect for the tireless work journalists do every day and sincerely regrets using Ms. Hondrick's, and I hope I'm saying her name right, as her own.
So she's admitting it.
Yeah, so this is not an allegedly anymore. She plagiarized. Let's talk about one of our sponsors. It is Factor. You can eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals.
Every fresh meal is never frozen and is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, and they are ready in just 2 minutes.
Where did you have chili the other day?
Delicious.
And if you want gourmet meals, you can try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, asparagus. So head to factormeals.com/impact50 and use code IMPACT50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box.
That code's IMPACT50 at factormeals.com/impact50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Impact 50 at factormeals.com/impact50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
My name is Bill Huffman, and I am a former Cleveland news producer, and I am now the host of the podcast Who Killed? I began the show focusing on the unsolved murder of Amy Mihaljevic, and now each week I explore a different case with a focus on some of the victims who don't get the attention they deserve. I have a deep catalog of over 225 episodes, so there is a guarantee there will be something for you. Who Killed is an Evergreen Podcast, Killer Podcasts, and Slow Burn Media production. Subscribe today wherever you get your favorite shows.
And so let's go back to what the defense is saying in their filing. They are questioning that her credibility is an issue because of some of these things. She's now admitted to plagiarism. We also have that they say that she has filed an affidavit back when the state initially filed their response to these jury tampering allegations.
And we know about that because we read some of it on the air.
Right, but because she has filed this affidavit, does that make her right to plead the fifth?
Null and void?
Null and void because she's already spoken about it. It's a good question. We'll have to see how Chief Justice Toll rules on this.
So you're saying that it's possible from the legal world that once you comment on something, right, you can't suddenly say, but now I'm not commenting. I'm breaking that down into layman's kind of terms.
Yes, yeah. Yes. You've already commented on it in a legal filing.
Right.
Then not, all of a sudden you it's not like it. You've just commented to your neighbor.
Right, right.
You've actually have an affidavit that you have addressed.
Now you're saying
you've
plead
denied,
the fifth.
And now you can't say now.
Retroactively
plead the fifth.
If you think back to those, we talked about it at the time, the affidavit was very, very carefully worded. It was very much like scripted, a very narrow scope. And so I would think you would need follow-up question, being the layperson here. For instance, she says things like, I did not tell the jury, quote, not to be fooled by evidence presented by Mr. Murdoch's attorneys. Okay, you might not have used those exact words. What else did you do? I did not instruct the jury to, quote, watch him closely. Again, was it the exact words? And was it instruct? Maybe that's the key word. She says, I did not discuss the evidence presented at trial with juror 785. Exactly what did she discuss? I did not inform juror 75 that everyone needs to be on the same page, in quotes. So again, does that mean that specifically she didn't use those words? That's why I would think you would need a follow-up. And again, she, according to the legal people we talked to, you can't plead the fifth after you've just filed this official affidavit.
And something else that they mention in this brief is, to quote, for example, emails released to journalists in response to FOIA requests show that Ms. Hill was sending emails directly to prosecutors and law enforcement witnesses for the state during the trial for the merits of testimony from the defense witnesses under examination at the moment. So she sent emails to the state and law enforcement, but did not send emails to the defense.
So they're showing bias.
That's what this is contending. And let's move on to an article from John Monk with the State Paper. And he has a couple of attorneys quoted about this situation. Jay Bender, who was the media liaison for the Murdoch trial and is also an attorney, when he asked about these plagiarism, he says it's a separate issue and that they occurred at different times. This was not something that occurred during the trial. And he is quoted as saying it is irrelevant to the issue before the court. That was his opinion on it. We also have Joe McCullough, who we've had on our show a few times, and he represents two of the jurors. He says plagiarism is not really a crime, so I don't know under the rules of evidence if it would be pertinent to an impeachment discrediting basis. He goes on to say that the judge is going to be laser focused on whether there were communications between any court official and any member of the jury. And if there was, did it interfere with or in any way pollute the neutrality of the jury?
In that statement, at least, and we'll have him on soon, saying the plagiarism thing, he also agrees with Bender that it does not affect whether this happened or not or whether what the ruling will be or anything like that.
Well, it's possible that Judge Toll may decide that these allegations and also the ethics charges that she's facing, whether she was writing a book or moving funds or using federal funds for this child support stuff, they have nothing to do with this ethics investigation.
And whether she is, well, first of all, she hasn't been found guilty on the
But
some of those.
And in this filing, we obviously know that the defense is going on record saying, no, we think this is an issue. We think this is relevant. Her credibility, because why are we going to believe what she says versus what a juror says if she is, not.
They're saying there's some shady stuff around her.
Right. We also hear from Eric Bland in this article, who is representing four of the jurors. And he says that if Becky Hill was his client, he may not allow her to take the stand. He is also quoted as saying, if she takes the fifth, there is an adverse inference in the legal term, meaning a negative conclusion can be assumed about what her testimony might have been. And I'm not sure if that's accurate, because a negative inference does not apply to criminal proceedings. I think it's only civil.
And the way I understand it is, in a criminal proceeding, the judge would even say, this person pleading the fifth does not in any way, I don't know how he'd officially affirm, but like, this doesn't mean negative thing. He even informs the jury to not take a negative attachment to that.
Right, because in that case, criminal defense attorneys would probably bring people in all the time and say, was that your gun?
I plead the fifth.
And then that's a negative.
And they're like, oh, then it must be his.
It must be. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. He said, right. So, yes. So, good point there, Seton.
Let's talk about how the defense is hoping this evidentiary hearing will look.
Before we do that, I'm going to tell you, you're going to hear the in-camera mentioned, right? And in-camera, the definition is in private, in particular taking place in the private chambers of a judge with the press and public excluded. It's a bit confusing sometimes because in-camera sounds like on-camera.
On-camera, but it's different.
It's complete opposite.
I think what they're saying is they want these just in front of the judge.
Just in-camera, or in-camera, Latin for in a chamber.
Yes.
So in the pre-hearing brief by the defense, that would be letter G, jurors and Judge Newman, if necessary, should be examined in-camera by the court, but other witnesses should be examined by counsel in open court.
Right, and so by the court would be Chief Justice Toll conducting the questioning.
Mm-hmm. In chambers. So, and I think that we're going to find that everybody involved is pretty much in lockstep with, at least both sides, in lockstep with putting the jurors in chambers.
But there would be a publicly available transcript. That's what they're suggesting.
But all the other witnesses, it would be in public.
Open court, yes. Yep. And I think the question that they really want to tackle is whether communication occurred, and if so, the context and the substance.
Now, we also have within this filing a line that says counsel for non-parties should not be permitted to participate in these proceedings, which is about attorney Eric Bland.
They quote some of the things that he has said on his podcast.
He has requested to participate in the proceedings as counsel for certain jurors who may be called to testify as witnesses. Mr. Murdoch objects to Mr. Bland's request. This is a criminal proceeding brought by the state against the defendant. Mr. Bland seeks a level of non-party participation beyond even the rights afforded victims under certain law, blah, 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 blah. And the jurors he represents are not crime victims. In discussing the request in the media, Mr. Bland stated on his podcast that Justice Toll, the newly assigned presiding judge in this matter, quote, has friends sometimes to reward and enemies to punish, and quote, I worry about what procedures are going to be put in place. The fact that there was a status conference, and I represent four jurors, and I wasn't even told of the status conference, and I believe that my jurors have the right to legal representation in any type of proceeding dealing with Alec Murdoch's verdicts, where they're going to have their verdicts questioned. So he stated interest in to be there when all these things are happening, and they're saying, no, that's not the way it works.
Well, and in this filing, they say that this violates Mr. Murdoch's 14th Amendment rights, but I question whether they were just trying to let Chief Justice Toll know what Bland was saying.
Let's move to the state's pre-hearing brief in the opposition to defense motion for a new trial. What jumps out at you first. I guess the first one being the burden of proof.
Yeah, they're saying it still rests with Murdoch.
And the way they word it is, Murdoch must carry the burden of proving both that an improper contact occurred with the jury and that he was actually prejudiced thereby.
Right. So that's that whole thing of even if this improper conduct did occur, it would have had to change the outcome.
Right. Or change at least one of the jurors' minds. Then they also talk about, they try to pitch that evidentiary hearing is unnecessary, but it looks like that's happening.
It does look like it's happening, but in their response, they say not a single juror who actually deliberated in the case indicates that their deliberations or verdict was in any way affected by the improper contacts alleged. The jurors were polled individually and affirmed their verdicts on the record.
When we have told you about that ad nauseum, that the defense is saying doesn't matter whether they say they were influenced or not. If it happened, that's enough.
Exactly.
Then they talk about judicially conducted limited questioning. Should the court deem an evidentiary hearing necessary, which it looks like they're happening, the procedure should be judicially guided and the scope of relevant evidence is limited.
These are the questions that they want to ask the jury. Said, on March 2nd, 2023, did you answer when polled that your verdict was guilty on each of the charges? That's the first question they want asked. And the second was, as you were instructed to do so by Judge Newman, was your verdict on March 2nd, 2023, based solely on the testimony, evidence, law, and arguments of counsel presented at trial?
The states want only those two questions asked. And do they say if those, the only 12 jurors, if they say yes and yes, then it's over with. They don't even have an evidentiary hearing. But that doesn't include the alternate or the egg juror that was kicked off. So if it seems like we spend a lot more time on the defense, it's probably because there was 21 or 22 pages in their filing and there's 7 pages by the state. That we're not trying to show any, and we could just be repeating and rehashing because there's just two, as we see it, two big issues.
Yep. The first one is Becky Hill's credibility and how that may or may not influence this evidentiary hearing.
And whether or not she can plead the fifth.
Yep.
That's all kind of one. And then the second big question, which is very obvious by these filings.
Right. So we have, if this improper communication happened between Becky Hill and jurors, is that enough? Or did that communication have to in some way influence the outcome of the trial, the guilty verdict?
I think that is even bigger than the Becky Hill credibility thing. I really think that's what it's going to come down to Justice Toll. Whether she goes, a court official says something improper, that's enough, new trial. Or she goes with, if a court official says something, you better prove that it swayed a juror's decision.
We also have to prove that these communications happened. And were they improper?
Right, exactly. And there's more on Becky Hill. Fitz News has an article about, I guess, phone shenanigans, if you will, taking place with not only Becky Hill, but Becky Hill's son, who's been accused of wiretapping another government employee. And the Fitz News article is in great detail. You can read it over there. But basically, there was a situation where there are phones possibly missing, 6 cell phones between Becky Hill and her son. 2 of them have been allegedly destroyed. 2 of them were on a factory reset. 1 was reportedly missing, and 1 which investigators have in their possession, but it's not the device they sought via the subpoena. And Fitz News breaks down the timeline of how Becky's son was getting rid of phones and changing phones to different lines, allegedly, and Becky Hill was doing the same. And the phone that Becky used during the Murdoch trial is a different one they were able to get a hold of. They go into great detail on that. You can go to Fitz News and find out more.
And there are possible implications, if this is true, of obstruction of justice. I mean, that they were intentionally getting rid of phones. I think what they said at one point in the article, that Jeffrey Hill disposed of 1 phone in a dumpster after he knew the walls were closing in.
And how often do people throw away phones, right? A whole phone. I mean, I don't.
And don't know where Becky Hill's phone. Becky Hill had a Samsung phone, which was she traded in for an iPhone. And That's what SLED was seeking to find, but that phone is, you know, missing.
And some of these phones are government phones, which is even more interesting.
Well, and another thing that they say in this article, to quote, it says, even more problematic, we have received troubling reports that SLED agents and officials sought at various points during the investigation to downplay any possible connection between Jeffrey Hill's eavesdropping of Ootsie and ethics investigation into Hill.
Before we wrap, couple of comments.
We have one that I thought was funny to read just because you got a similar one last week. Seton, please leave. Your constant harping on being biased is inaccurate and tiresome. You seem to love taking cheap shots at two journalists in particular. Don't do that. It's unprofessional and obvious. Intelligent people should always be questioning and not seeking to integrate themselves with the fringe element for ratings.
I have no idea what that means.
I don't either.
We have not talked about other journalists in a negative way.
Run for the hills, Matt.
Yeah!
I know you've thought about that.
That's because last week it was telling you to run for the hills.
I know. And it was funny because we got a lot of criticism after we interviewed Neil Gordon that we were too tough on Becky Hill. Very next episode, we went through Becky Hill's response to the ethics complaint, and then we were too easy on Becky Hill.
Hey.
We are not in one camp or the other. We are on the side of presenting information and letting y'all make up your own minds.
And we still appreciate it. We're not at least a bit offended by your comments and
reviews. And I got someone had reached out to me that we misspoke, and instead of the kennel video, we called it the Snapchat video. So sometimes we do make mistakes, and we appreciate
you. Snapchat was the tree one,
right? And the kennel videos was Paul talking to his friends
On
his phone. So yes, we do make mistakes along the way, and we are happy for you to point them out.
Love it, and we are grateful. We would hope that you'd rate and share the episode, make a comment, reach out to us on Impact of Influence podcast page or the Evergreen Podcast Company, and we'll talk soon, friend.
Something is creeping, don't follow it down.
Let me introduce you to Barry Clue, an authorized financial advisor from New Zealand and a very special kind of stain on humanity.
He was a very knowledgeable young guy.
He was a registered financial advisor.
Type of guy that was bending over backwards to help you.
Now, you could be forgiven for thinking that Barry sounds like a great guy. And you'd be right. Well, right up until the point when you're wrong.
It was all fictitious.
You stole from my son, who has a disability.
Chris never knew. He died believing that we're all taken care of.
A psychopath is somebody who lacks empathy, acts impulsively. I think there's a strong case that Barry might be all of those things, actually.
To find out how Barry Clue stole over $15 million from 81 victims, subscribe to Clueless, The Long Con. That's Clueless, spelt Clooghless.
I'm an American vigilante. I have a question for you. What would you do if someone you cared about was abducted, taken from you? Would you call me? Would you care about how I got them back? Download American Vigilante now.